Before we go into the Chittamatra philosophical system, I'd like to do a little review of some of the main points of the Vaibhashika Santrantika that we covered last week. And before that, I'd like to do a short meditation, particularly related to the first two schools, the Santrantika and the Vaibhashika. So remember, in those two systems, the fundamental ignorance was grasping onto self of person. In particular, grasping onto what was called this self-sufficient, substantially existent self. That instinctively, we tend to have a sense that there's a me here somewhere, and this me seems to be something more than merely the body and the mind. There seems to be something extra. We have that in our language. You know, we say, I have a body, I have a mind, as if there's a third thing, a me, that sort of stands apart from the body and the mind, that is the possessor of the body and the mind. And instinctively, we have this sense of me. So I'd like to do a little meditation to have a look and see if we can find a me, something more than merely the body and the mind. So we did a meditation very similar to this last week, but I think it's good to do another one slightly differently, but again, looking for this self, see if it really is, there is one here. So let's do that meditation first. So we begin by preparing the body, keeping the back nice and straight, and allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. Allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. And preparing the mind, not dwelling in the past, not anticipating the future, simply coming to rest in the present moment, focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness, of the sensations of the breath, throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. Now, do you have a sense that there is a me here who is trying to relax the body and trying to focus the mind on the breath? A me that doesn't seem to depend upon anything else to exist. You have this experience. Here is this me who is trying to become the master or controller of the body and mind. How does the body appear to exist? Does it seem to be a single solid thing? Even though it appears to be a single solid thing, if we look closely, what do we find? What do we see? What we see is a constant flow of physical change. Observe closely and see if there is a me to be found anywhere within this flow of physical change. Now, how does the mind appear to exist? Does it seem to be a single substantial thing? However, if we look closely at the mind, what do we find? Like the body, we simply see a flow of change, an unfolding flow of mental experience, constantly changing. Within that flow of change, called the mind, is there a me to be found? A me that is the master or controller of the body and the mind. Yet, other than this constant flow of physical change that is called the body, and the constant flow of mental experience called the mind, what else is there here? if there's nothing more than this, where is the me that possesses this body and mind? Where is the me that's trying to relax the body and focus the mind? However, it's undeniable that there's someone who's experiencing all of this. So there is a me. But how can this me exist if we don't seem to be able to find it anywhere? The me is something imputed or labelled on the basis of the body that is sitting here and the mind that is focusing on the breath. It is not self-sufficient or substantially existent. We've got the definition, of course, of self-cognizer in the Sautrantika system here. We can look at that. Middle of page 8, definition of valid self-cognizing perception. A new and non-deceptive cognition that is free from conceptuality is only inwardly directed and bears the aspect of an apprehending subject. So remember, the schools that posit the self-cognizer posit it in terms of thinking that we need something to be able to know the mind itself as a way of remembering the experience of the mind in the time of experiencing the object. So they say that the analogy they often give is the mind is like a lamp. It illuminates other objects and it also illuminates itself. So they say, and there's a number of schools that exert this, is that there's this self-cognizer present, which is, as the definition says here, is only inwardly directed, meaning it's only directed at itself and has an aspect of an apprehending subject. So it's only observing the mind itself in a non-dualistic, non-conceptual way. So this is what the schools who assert self-cognizer accept or assert. Some other schools say that the mind can't know itself simultaneously. You know, they often give like a sword can't cut itself, an eye can't see itself. So they have the analogy that the mind is like a measuring weight. Measuring weight can only weigh something else. It can't weigh itself, is the analogy they give. And so they say that the way we know to have awareness of the mind itself is through introspection, that in the next moment we're aware that we were aware of the object. The Prasangikas don't accept either of those two. They say that it's simply through association, and we'll look at that a little bit in the Prasangika. So they don't accept self-cognizing. So what I'd like to do is now just go through a couple of the main points of the Vaibhashika Sautrantika before we launch into the Chittamatra. So again, maybe we can use the four Buddhist tenet systems chart as the basis. And so what we see with the Vaibhashika and Sautrantikas, and each of the, of course, each of the systems we're looking at, there are seven outlines to the presentation. There's the definition, divisions, etymology, way of asserting objects, way of asserting object possessors, way of asserting selflessness, and then presentation of the grounds and paths. And so we saw in the definition of both the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, they're both propounding Hinayana tenets, meaning they're only really talking about overcoming the afflictive obscurations. And they're both accepting this truly existent external object. So for them, there's no problem with the way in which we see objects as existing independently and externally. And the difference between Vaibhashika Sautrantika, one difference, of course, there are a number, is that the Vaibhashika do not accept self-cognition, where the Sautrantika do accept self-cognition. So that's one difference we see in the definitions. And the divisions, we've already mentioned that the Vaibhashika is really this sort of collection of these 18 sub-schools that slowly formed after the time of the Buddha. Sautrantika, we have those two divisions of whether they're following from Vasubandhu's Abhidhammakosha or from Dharmakirti's treatises on valid cognition. And in terms of the objects, we saw that Vaibhashika have a couple of unique assertions that no other school has. One is that for them, even permanent phenomena are able to perform a function. So for all the other philosophical systems, of course, there are two types of existence. There are impermanent and permanent, and impermanent can perform a function and permanent cannot. Whereas Vaibhashika say that even permanent phenomena is able to perform a function. It's a little bit of a unique assertion. And also within the Vaibhashika, they assert this, the three times, past, present and future, to be instances or particulars of substances. Whereas most of the other schools, their assertion of past, present and future is that past is something which has arisen and ceased to exist, i.e. therefore then it's permanent, it's not changing. Present is that which has arisen and not ceased to exist, so that's changing, that's impermanent. And future is that yet which is yet to arise or has not yet arisen, so that's also unchanging. So for most schools, present is functional thing and past and future are permanent. But actually when we go into the Prasangika, they say all three times are impermanent. And we'll have a look at the Prasangika assertion a little bit later. It ties in a little bit with this idea of not having to talk about karmic imprints, this idea of disintegratedness. It's one of their unique assertions, but we'll touch on that when we get to Prasangika. And in terms of the objects, we talked about two truths. Whereas within Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, two truths are two classes of things. Whereas in the Chittamatra and Majjhimika, what we see is that the two truths apply to everything. Conventional truth are things that exist, and ultimate truth is how those things exist. Whereas in Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, the two truths are two classes of phenomena. And in Vaibhashika and the Sautrantikas following scripture, they both say that ultimate truth are these partless particles and partless moments of consciousness, because these are sort of the building blocks of the physical and mental universe. So for them, they are ultimate truth, whereas everything made up of them is conventional truth. So that's what we see in the Vaibhashika and the first half of the Sautrantika, the following scriptures. Whereas the Sautrantika following reasoning have another perspective of the two truths. And so they're actually moving more towards the Majjhimika or the Chittamatra Majjhimika systems in understanding what are we talking about when we talk about ultimate truth and conventional truth. So for them, ultimate truth is something that, and it's really coming towards the type of mind. So for that, so Sautrantika's following reasoning, a direct perceiver is seeing things clearly and accurately. So for them, then ultimate truth is the things that are perceived directly. Therefore, of course, what we see directly with a direct perceiver is changing things, functioning things. So for them, ultimate truth is everything that we directly experience through changing. Whereas for them, conventional truth are permanent phenomena which are merely understood through conception. So for them, permanent phenomena are the conventional truths. So they have this sort of a different idea about the two truths. And then, of course, when we look at the object possessors, the first part of that in each of the session in the different schools, we're looking at what's the illustration of person. What do we mean by when we really talk about person? And here, when we talk about illustration of person, we're really talking about what is the sort of the continuity in terms of what goes from life to life and what is carrying these sort of karmic imprints. So within all philosophical systems, they're finding that, they're pointing to something which provides that continuity. And in the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, as we saw, there are a number of different assertions. Even within the 18 subschools, there are a number of different assertions. Most of the Vaibhashikas assert that the collection of the aggregates, the body and the mind, is the person. Some assert the mental consciousness to be the person, and others assert that the actual continuum of the aggregates is the person. Whereas in the Sautrantikas, whether they're following scriptural reasoning, assert either the continuum of the aggregates or the mental consciousness. So what we see in these schools, plus all schools apart from Prasangika, there's something we can point to as being the illustration of the person. Within Prasangika, of course, we can't point to anything, because pointing to something implies that it inherently exists from its own side. So their answer is the mere I is the person. So what that means, we'll look at in the Prasangika. So they are different from all the other schools in saying that there's nothing you can really point to as being the illustration of the person. Whereas for all other schools, other than Prasangika, If it's not findable, it doesn't exist. For Prasangika, it must be not findable for it to exist. So that's a little difference, but we'll look at that. So that's in terms of person. And then we talk, and then there's a section about different types of awareness, valid cognition and non-valid cognition. And again, here, one of the unique assertions for Vaibhashika is the idea that actually an I sense power is a valid perception, whereas, of course, all other schools would not accept that. It has to be a consciousness for it to be a valid perception. And what we saw is that in the Satrantika, we had a quite an extensive presentation of valid cognition, non-valid cognition, and so forth. And that's really drawing on the works of Dharmakirti from the 7th century. He really was very well known for putting together this sort of epistemology in terms of how we know things and don't know things. So that's really drawing on Dharmakirti's works. And what we see in general with all the schools, again, below Prasangika, when we talk about valid cognition and non-valid cognition, the valid cognition is translation of Sanskrit word pramana, and pra here, based on Dharmakirti, is etymologized in terms of meaning new. So for all the schools apart from Prasangika, a valid cognition has to be a new cognition, meaning the first moment of a cognition. Whereas subsequent moments, which is called a subsequent cognizer, are not considered to be valid cognizers anymore because they're not a new cognition. Whereas Prasangika, when we talk about pramana, pra doesn't have the etymology of new, it just means prime. So for Prasangikas, the second moment of a valid cognition is still a valid cognition. So that's a little bit different for Prasangika. And then we talked about various types of valid cognition, and we have the valid perception, valid inference, and in valid perception we have the sense, mental and yogic, and then of course for Satrantika also the self-cognizing perception. So we won't go through those again. And then we went into the sixth section, which is the way of asserting selflessness. Well, actually before that, it comes in the context of asserting selflessness, so we can mention it here. So in terms of selflessness, remember we talked about the four seals, that all Buddhist schools accept that all phenomena are empty and selfless. In these two schools, of course, Vaibhashika Satrantika, as we see here in the presentation, is that we can talk about selflessness of person, and we can talk about selflessness of person at two levels. So remember that there were a number of philosophical systems at the time of the Buddha, a number of traditions, that also talked about life after life and liberation and so forth. So they also have to posit what is the illustration of the person, what is it that goes from life to life and so forth. And a number of these traditions posited a self that was unchanging, unitary, and independent. Of course, all Buddhist philosophical systems refute that idea of person. And they all consider it to be a coarse idea of self, of person. So the coarse selfness as a person is the fact there is no unitary, unchanging, independent person or self. But then we can talk about subtle selflessness of person. And that is, again, all of the Buddhist philosophical systems refute the idea that there's this self-sufficient, substantially existent self. And that's what the meditation we did was relating to that, is that we do instinctively grasp onto this sense of self. We have a sense that there's something more than the body and the mind here. There's something more standing apart. There's this self or me that instinctively doesn't seem to depend on the body and the mind. It seems to be self-sufficient and very substantial. Of course, intellectually, if we look at that, we can maybe quite easily appreciate that actually there's a body and there's a mind. There's nothing more than that here. So maybe intellectually we could appreciate that. But that's not enough, of course, because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. So even though intellectually we may appreciate there's only a body and a mind, there's nothing more, there's not a third thing called me that's extra, instinctively we do have that sense. We really do have that instinctive false sense of me. That's this grasping to self, and that is the selflessness of person, or what's called subtle selflessness of person, that both Vaibhashika, Satrantika, but also, as we're going to see today and tomorrow, the Chittamatra and the Svatantrika, Majjhamika, all of them are in agreement in that if we can eliminate that, if we can realize that selflessness of person, we can achieve liberation, we can achieve nirvana. The Prasangikas also assert that we need to eliminate that, but for Prasangikas, that's not enough to achieve liberation. It's helpful, but we have a deeper level of ignorance we need to eliminate. What that is, we'll look at when we get to the Prasangika section. And then, of course, for both Vaibhashika and Satrantika, they do not accept a selflessness of phenomena, because for them, all phenomena truly exist. And then in terms of the actual grounds and paths, so again, remember, in terms of the objects of abandonment, for Vaibhashika Satrantika, the object of abandonment is the afflictive obscurations. So the afflictive obscurations are the mental afflictions. And sometimes, of course, it's mentioned the root of those mental afflictions is this conception grasping onto self of person, grasping onto a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. So sometimes the afflictive obscurations here is mentioned as just that. Sometimes it's mentioned it's that plus, in fact, it mentions that plus the three poisons that arise due to the force of that. So it talks about that plus all the mental afflictions that come from that as the afflictive obscurations. And so again, remember here, neither of them accept cognitive obscurations. So there's just the afflictive. They do talk about these non-afflictive obscurations that Prince Siddhartha overcame, and that meant he had this all-knowingness and he had more ability than anyone else. But they don't talk about cognitive obscurations. And then in terms of the grounds and paths, how we progress along the path, particularly as we're going to see when we go into the Majjhamika, particularly Prasangika, we really do talk about these five stages called the five paths: path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, path of normal learning. And we'll look at those five paths in much more detail when we go into the Prasangika. But what we find here is in this presentation, we're also using a similar presentation for Vaibhashika Satrantika, in that a path of seeing, when we get to that point, we're seeing nature of reality directly. So here, in Vaibhashika Satrantika, when we achieve path of seeing, we have a direct realization of this selfness as a person, and then we're eliminating these afflictive obscurations on the path of seeing, path of meditation, before we achieve the path of no more learning. And what we saw was that there's a little bit of a difference here between Vaibhashika and Satrantika. For the Vaibhashikas and Satrantikas, in fact, for all the schools, we can talk about three types of practitioner or three lineages, what's called the hearer, solitary realizer, and the bodhisattva. And so the Vaibhashikas say that for both the solitary realizer and the bodhisattva, when they get to the path of preparation, they sit down in one session, they meditate, they go through path of preparation, seeing, meditation, and into no more learning in one meditation session. And it's only the hearer that has to sort of move through those stages over a number of lives. Whereas in the Satrantika, they assert that
actually all of them need to sort of go through those five paths over many lives. They can't sort of in one session go from path of preparation to the becoming an arhat. And also what we saw was that, and it's not directly mentioned in this text, tenets text, but it is mentioned in quite some detail in this tenets text. And actually, you'll find that in any school or any Buddhist tradition that sort of follows these philosophical tenets of Vaibhashika or Satrantika, they tend not to use the five path model. They tend to use what's called the four result or eight person model. So remember, those four results were stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, and arhat. And the eight persons are the ones that are approaching and abiding in each of those results. So we can talk about progressing through those four stages of becoming a stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, and then eventually becoming an arhat. And we briefly looked last week at sometimes an extensive presentation of that lists what's called the 20 Sangha. It lists sort of 20 examples of typical points along that progression from stream enterer to arhat. So we had a little bit of a flavor of what some things, what points we can get to in various parts through that progression. So we have that as the normally the presentation within these two philosophical systems. So then just to summarize very briefly, and then we'll go on to the Chittamatra school, I'd like to read a little bit from this book here on page 20. And this is from the two authors, Daniel Kosort and Craig Preston. They're giving their own little summary of Vaibhashika Satrantika. So maybe a couple of interesting points that they raise, and then we'll go on to the Chittamatra system. So it says here, Vaibhashika is a cover term for many small sects that can be identified in early Buddhism. There are generally held to be 18 sub-schools, although different ancient authors have different lists. Historically, the most important sub-school seems to be that have been the Savastivada. Their relationships are very complex, as our text indicates. The term Vaibhashika means follower of Mahavibhasa, an anonymous collection of teachings on the topics of Abhidharma. However, not all of them follow that text, about which our authors knew very little anyway because it had not been translated in Tibetan. Tibetan authors take Vasubandhu's 4th century Abhidharma Kosha as their main source for understanding Vaibhashika. So remember, the Abhidharma Kosha was really written as a description of Vaibhashika tenets, and then Vasubandhu's auto-commentary on that, he wrote an auto-commentary criticizing some of those points, i.e. his auto-commentary is reflecting the Satrantika philosophical system. Philosophically, Vaibhashikas are the most realist of the schools in sense they regard as truly real the tiny atoms out of which material things are made. Anything larger, constructed out of an aggregation of these atoms, is just imputedly existent and is conventional as opposed to ultimate. Satrantika just means followers of sutra, which in itself would seem to mean nothing because all Buddhist schools are followers of scripture. However, Satrantikas doubt the Abhidharma literature or the Mahayana scriptures are the words of Buddha. Therefore, they rely on their unique list of authentic scriptures. So the Satrantikas probably began as dissenters from Vaibhashika who rely on the Abhidharma to such a great extent. Some are called followers of reasoning because they rely on works of Dignaga and Dharmakirti who lived in the 5th and 7th centuries and are renowned for the development of logic and epistemology in response to Hindu schools. They differ from Vaibhashikas and other Satrantikas in many small ways, such as the way in which they define ultimate and conventional truth. Others are called followers of scripture, which really means only that they are not followers of reasoning. They rely on Vasubandhu's explanation of Abhidharma Kosha, wherein he modifies some of the positions of his original Vaibhashika work. So that's a little bit of Vaibhashika Satrantika summary. Any
last questions about Vaibhashika or Satrantika before we move on to the Chittamatra school. So remember the 18 sub-schools mainly formed after the time of the Buddha, way before the Abhidhamma Kosha was written. Abhidhamma Kosha is 4th century. So what I think you're saying is that these Tibetan tenets texts are using Abhidhamma Kosha to clarify the positions of these 18 subschools. So the 18 subschools were not following Abhidhamma Kosha because they existed prior to Abhidhamma Kosha. But Vasubandhu, his Abhidhamma Kosha text, was written in alignment with these schools, and that's what he's suggesting is being used by these Tibetan commentators to get a clearer picture of some of those very early assertions. Because this Mahavibhasa, I think what he was saying, was never translated into Tibetan. So to actually get a clear picture of what these individual assertions were wouldn't be very easy. So they weren't following Abhidhamma Kosha, those 18 subschools, but Abhidhamma Kosha was written as a text describing their positions, or some of their positions.
Who originally wrote
what? Abhidhamma Kosha was Vasubandhu in the 4th century, but these 18 subschools already were forming directly after the time of the Buddha.
So he wrote about what they were doing.
He wrote, his Abhidhamma Kosha is a text describing their position, which was already established centuries before. So some of these 18 subschools were being formed, 700-800 years before Vasubandhu. And then in his auto commentary, he commented on his Abhidhamma Kosha from a Satrantika perspective. Satrantika didn't exist, but he criticized some of those views, and those criticisms then became, the differences then started to become what's called Satrantika system. And then later, of course, Dharmakirti also added his commentary, and so then we have those two Satrantika subschools, the differences between them.
Is there anyone that's suggested that Vasubandhu may have mischaracterized those 18 subschools and that they had better reasoning than we?
So remember these 18 subschools also had, that's why there was 18 subschools, is they had disagreements among themselves. And from those early days, there are probably not any texts still existent that are describing those very subtle differences. So that's why later it's hard to even know what the different assertions were of these 18 subschools.
Has it just been sort of subsumed into the Dhammaka presentation, or does it not exist at all?
So again, what we have to understand is what is being currently followed now in the various Buddhist schools. We have to look. I mean, this is the historical perspective of the development of these views from the time of the Buddha, particularly up through about the 7th or 8th century. That's when all of these ideas really formulated up to that point. And then, of course, what happened after that in terms of the various Buddhist traditions, we have to investigate whether they're even really following some of these ideas or not. So certainly, within Dharmakirti, he's made a lot of input in the Sautrantika and the Chittamatra systems. And certainly in terms of his epistemology and logic, this is actually used as one of the core things within the Tibetan schools, which are following the Prasangika. So, you know, of course, there's some differences in terms of this valid cognition in terms of new or not. But a lot of the ideas that we follow in the Tibetan system, which is really following Prasangika, is Dharmakirti from that, plus also a lot of the Sautrantika ideas is being used in terms of this valid cognition and so forth. So, you know, a lot of these ideas, of course, and then we look behind it and though, you know, the none of the Tibetan systems would accept that things inherently exist and so forth. But there are elements of those systems which are useful even in the Prasangika. Family tree. Yes, you'll find, I mean, particularly these 18 subschools and how they formed. There's quite an extensive presentation in here about the various, from Jeffrey Hopkins, and he has a similar thing in his Meditation on Emptiness. So there are a number of different assertions as how these 18 subschools even came about originally.
I think he visualized all about the main schools and subschools.
Yeah, so remember again, this is what we're following is Tibetan tenets text looking back on all the things. So even within the different Tibetan schools, I think you're going to find some differences in terms of how they present the different schools and sub-schools and so forth. You will find differences even there, let alone going to other Mahayana schools and so forth. If you go into like Zen or Chinese Buddhism in terms of what they would, they'd probably say something a little bit different again. Okay, let's briefly jump into Chittamatra for 5 minutes before we go for lunch. Just so we've got something to digest over lunch. But not too much so that we get indigestion. We'll just take a little few nibblies before lunch. Wait for the indigestion after lunch. So again, the Chittamatra on page 13, same seven outlines. So definition. Definition of a proponent of Chittamatra. And the Chittamatra, again, is often translated into English as mind only, because things are only the nature of the mind. So it's a person propounding Mahayana tenets who does not assert external objects, but does accept truly existent self-cognition. So Chittamatra is another philosophical system that says that asserts self-cognition to be able to understand how the mind knows itself. Again, propounding Mahayana tenets. So here, as with the Majjhimika, what we're going to see is in the Mahayana, there really is this clear distinction between the goal of nirvana and the goal of enlightenment, and that there's a talk about the two obscurations, not just the afflictive obscurations, but then we have to eliminate the cognitive obscurations to move from the goal of nirvana to enlightenment. And as we're going to see, apart from one sort of sub-school in Chittamatra, the general assertion is that everyone will eventually achieve the goal of enlightenment. There is one sub-school in Chittamatra that does not accept that, but we'll have a look at that. But apart from that, in general, everyone will eventually achieve the goal of enlightenment. And so here are some synonyms: proponent of Chittamatra, proponent of cognition, and yogic practitioner, yogacara, are equivalent. So there's some equivalent terms we have for that. In terms of divisions, here it's divided into what's called true aspectarians and false aspectarians. There is also a division, as we see in that footnote, of followers of scripture and followers of reasoning. And that's, in fact, in the four Buddhist tenet systems, we have that division mentioned here. That again, there are Chittamatras, followers of scripture, are the ones who are following a Sangha, and the followers of reasoning are following Dharmakirti. Now, as we're going to see in this tenets text, it seems that there is a correlation between true aspect here and false aspect here, and followers of scripture and followers of reasoning. There is a sort of parallel there. But actually, in the this text here from Jamyang Shepa, the tenets text, he actually makes a specific point and says, well, actually, there are both true and false aspectarians who are followers of scripture, and there are true and false aspectarians who are followers of reasoning. Although this text seems to suggest at least there's a very strong correlation. If you're a follower of a true aspectarian and false aspectarian, whether you follow reasoning or scripture, just to sort of be aware of that. So actually that's all I really wanted to mention. What I want to do before we go further in the text is, in the definition it says, they do not assert external objects. So what I'd like to do, which is not really mentioned in this tenets text, is what are the reasonings they use, some of the typical reasonings they use to refute external objects. Here, of course, it says that they don't exist as the selfness is a phenomena, but there are a number of typical reasonings and analogies they use to assert the fact that there are no external objects. So I'd like to go into that because they are mentioned in this tenets text. So I'd like to go into that a little bit just to get an idea of how they come up with the idea that there's no external objects. You know, what are the sort of the reasonings and analogies they use to substantiate that? I'd like to look at that. I didn't want to bring it in now and get a little bit of indigestion for lunch, so we can have a nice relaxed lunch. And then when we're all charged up after lunch, we can have a look at that, and then we'll go into the Chittamatra text here and in the tenets text. So then it's lunchtime, but again, before we run off to lunch, we've got the food offering prayer. So I think today the food is separate in the cafe. There should be a table with the buffet set up, so it should be over there. So let's do the food offering prayer first, and then we'll go and have some lunch. Om Ahum, Om Ahum, Om Ahum. To the precious Buddha, peerless guide. To the precious Dharma, peerless refuge. To the precious Sangha, peerless liberators. We offer to the three jewels of refuge. This food with 100 flavors, attractive and well prepared, is offered to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas with devotion. May all beings enjoy the wealth of the food of concentration. Seeing this food as medicine, we eat it without attachment or hatred, not out of avarice, pride, or wish for an enviable body, only to sustain the body. Okay, let's break for lunch. Come back at 2:00.